with all the features we take for granted, took humans over 40 millennia. It actually took us most of that just to invent fractions, an idea so basic that we now teach it to literal babies. Because of that, the following table of features to add to your number system is actually the most time-saving table in history. And here we have table 5, which has a column labeled feature, an example of that feature, what you can do with it, why you want it, and when it was first invented. The first feature is written numbers, an example are the tallies we talked about earlier. What you can do with this is not have to remember numbers in your head all the time. You want it because you have finite space in your brain and because it's hard to do long division in your head. They were first invented around 40,000 BCE. The next feature is abstract numbers, an example of that is the number 5. What you can do with this, you can conceive of numbers as abstract ideas, i.e. 1 and 5, instead of being limited to counting things that actually exist, i.e. 1 sheep and 5 goats. Numbers that exist outside the things they're counting allows you to access new planes of abstract numerical thought instead of just reminiscing about specific sheep and goats all the time. Why you want it? Numbers as a purely abstract object are necessary to unlock future innovations in numbers, like irrational and imaginary numbers. It is not a coincidence that both these numbers are named in such a way as to make their very existence sound completely crazy, but they're also very practical. They were first invented around 3100 BCE. The next feature is fractions. An example is 1/2. With fractions, you can represent things that aren't whole numbers like 1, 2, or 3. You can talk about parts of things. Why you want it? Because sometimes you have 4 apples, but then Chad ate 3.5 of your apples, and you'd like to say, "Hey Chad, you owe me 3.5 apples," not have him get out of it by replying, "Based on our understanding of what numbers can do, what you have just said is nonsensical." Fractions first appear around 1000 BCE. The next feature is rational numbers. An example is 0.5. Rational numbers represent things that aren't whole numbers and let you avoid having to mess around with fractions. Any fraction can be written as a rational number and vice versa. Why you want it? Because adding 201 hundredths and 3 halves together is kind of a pain, but adding 2.01 plus a 1.50 is easy. We just did it. It's 3.51, no big deal. They were first invented around 1000 BCE. The next feature is irrational numbers, examples being the square root of 2 or pi. Irrational numbers let you represent numbers that are a lot like rational numbers, except when you write them out, they actually go on forever, never repeating or terminating. You want them because there are an infinite number of irrational numbers, so it'd be nice to have a number system that can handle that without exploding. Also, pi, which is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter, is one of the fundamental constants of the universe that gets used all the time when building things, so irrational numbers are practical too. Bonus. They were first invented around 800 BCE. The next feature is prime numbers, examples of which include 2, 3, 5, 7, and 982,451,653, any positive number that's greater than 1 and that is divisible only by 1 and itself. What you can do with prime numbers, nothing save for appreciating the beauty of pure mathematical study, until of course you invent public key cryptography, which absolutely relies on prime numbers and is extremely useful. You want them because there are an infinite number of prime numbers, although there is no way to know which numbers are prime until you test them. This makes prime numbers one of the only infinite, inexhaustible natural resources in the universe. Don't you want access to an infinite and inexhaustible natural resource? Yes, you do. They're first discovered around 300 BCE. The next feature is negative numbers. Example is negative 5. With them, you can conceive of the entire other half of the number system, so your numbers just don't stop at 1. You can also deal with a concept and its opposite concept in a single number, like heat and cold, income and expenses, expansion and contraction, acceleration and braking, and so on. You want them to capture change in both directions in a single number. Negative signs also give numbers an emotional connotation for the first time. Negative numbers are usually seen as bad, which can be useful when you want people to react emotionally to a number. Also, it's nice to be able to say what 1 minus 2 is without your head exploding. Negative numbers were first invented in 200 BCE, but listen, European mathematicians as late as 1759 CE were still arguing that negative numbers were nonsensical and absurd, which should tell you all you need to know about European mathematicians as late as 1759 CE. The next feature is zero. What you can do with zero is talk about nothing for the first time, But you can also have a number system that's place-based, so you can write numbers like 206 and not have them confused with 26. Why you want it? Because otherwise you have a number system that doesn't know what zero is, and that's extremely embarrassing. Zero works as both a placeholder, as in 206 showing 200 zero tens and six ones, and as a number that can be used like any other in mathematical operations, with some caveats. There'll be a sidebar for that coming up. Zero existed as a placeholder back in the 1700s BCE, but it took until 628 CE for a concept of zero that you can add, subtract, and multiply with to be realized. You will save so much time right now by just telling everyone 5 plus 0 equals 5, and you should write that down. The next feature is real numbers. Examples are 3.1, 3.11, 3.111, 3.11111, 3.11111. There's more, but we'll stop because we could literally be here forever. With real numbers, you merge both the rational and irrational number systems into a single number system. You can now describe any number with a potentially infinite decimal notation. You can explore the infinitely many numbers that exist between each and every whole number. Why you want real numbers? To blow your mind by considering that while there's an infinite number of numbers between 3 and 4, these also include numbers like pi, which are themselves infinite. You now have a whole lot of numbers, so congrats. They were first discovered in 1600 CE. The next feature is imaginary numbers, an example of which is the square root of negative 1, also known as I. Another example is 3.98i. Imaginary numbers let you manipulate numbers that include the square root of negative 1 in them. The square root of a number is a smaller number that, when multiplied by itself, produces your original number. The square root of negative 1 is impossible in the real number system, since any number multiplied by itself has to be positive. So mathematicians said, okay, well, let's imagine that it is possible, and let's call that number I, and that's whatever the square root of negative 1 is. You want them because, while they may sound like a complete waste of time, and the name imaginary numbers was originally intended as a brutally sick burn for just this reason, but they actually have practical applications from everything from modeling electrical flow to the swing of a pendulum in the air. They're first invented around 10 CE, but generally considered fictitious or useless, like negative numbers, until the 1700 CE. And the final feature is complex numbers, like 3 plus 2i. Complex numbers are imaginary numbers and real numbers mixed together. You want them because they're useful in fluid dynamics, quantum mechanics, electrical engineering, and calculations in special and general relativity. It's really useful to have these numbers in your back pocket in case anyone in your civilization invents these things we just mentioned. They were first invented around the 1800 CE. This concludes Table 5, which is labeled Homo sapiens sapiens, a species that considers itself so smart that it put smart in its own name twice and in Latin, took more than 40,000 years to figure this chart out. See all these ideas? We cover them in a single chart that took you a few minutes to read at most. You can introduce them in an afternoon, saving thousands and thousands of years that humans wasted wandering around not knowing what a zero is. You're welcome. As for the other things you can do with this number system, well, that's up to you. There are a bunch of useful mathematical formulas that took humanity a while to figure out sprinkled throughout this guide, but here's the deepest, darkest secret of math. You can build up the fundamentals of mathematics however you choose. It may surprise you to hear this, but mathematics is actually built on a foundation of things we can't prove, but assume are true. We call them axioms, and we think they're safe assumptions, but at the end of the day, they remain beliefs we can't prove. Axioms include ideas like 2 plus 1 gives the same result as 1 plus 2, and if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. These assumptions are useful because they match up with reality, and building math on a foundation that matches up with reality has proven reasonably practical, but there is nothing stopping you from building different mathematical systems. While we do recommend building math that is practical first, it can be quite entertaining to figure out how multiplication would work in a universe where A plus B is not the same as B plus A. Footnote. If you're interested, the answer to the question of, but seriously, how does multiplication work in such a system is, quite well, thank you. End of footnote. Now that you've invented non-sucky numbers and the basics of math to go along with them, you have unlocked several perks. Numbers obviously let you precisely quantify the world around you, which will be the basis of everything from cookbooks to accounting to science. physical resources like sheep or trees or abstract resources like money, popularity, and time itself are all managed, understood, and communicated through numbers. Most universally, numbers act as a sortable set of labels. Page 123 of a book is intuitively between page 122 and 124. If you know how many pages that book has, you have a pretty good idea of where that page will be. The context a sorted set of numbers provides will be very useful to members of your civilization down the road, whether they one day use them to label the hours in a day, the days in a year, the buildings on a street, or the floors in those buildings. They can also be used to label temperatures, radio frequencies, vitamins, and maybe, one day, if your civilization is very lucky, the strength of unstable Einstein-Rosen bridges constructed across disparate spatial-temporal reference frames. Sidebar, why can't you divide by zero? Division by zero is famously impossible. Footnote, for definitions of famous, liberal enough to include properties of mathematical systems. End of footnote. The reason is not that it will create a black hole, but rather because it exposes a contradiction at the heart of our mathematical system. Consider taking a number, let's use 1, and dividing it by progressively smaller numbers that approach but never quite reach 0. 0 marks the point where negative numbers end and positive numbers begin. If we approach it from the positive side, we'll see that 1 divided by 1 is 1. 1 divided by 0.1 is 10. And 1 divided by 0.001 is 1,000. The smaller the number you divide by gets, the larger the result gets. Therefore, 1 divided by 0 should equal infinity. But there's a problem if we approach 0 from the opposite end, dividing it by progressively smaller negative numbers, again getting closer and closer to 0. Here we can see that 1 divided by negative 1 equals negative 1, 1 divided by negative 0.1 equals negative 10, and 1 divided by negative 0.001 is negative 1,000. So here the smaller the number you divide by, the closer it gets to negative infinity. So by this logic, 1 divided by 0 should equal negative infinity. But a number can't be equal to infinity and negative infinity at the same time. That is, in fact, just about as unequal as two numbers can possibly get. So we've got a contradiction. And it's this contradiction that makes us say, you can't divide by 0, because the answer doesn't make sense, and nobody knows how to fix that yet. Section 3.4, the scientific method. Much improved over the earlier scientific approximation. People who build time machines tend to love science, as they generally tend to be scientists by training, or at least well-intentioned amateurs who have no idea of the powers they are about to unleash until a bunch of their future selves come back to warn them. But it's important to remember that even science has its limitations and is not an oracle of truth. In fact, science is merely 1, provisional, 2, contingent, and 3, our best effort so far. Here's the bad news. The scientific method can produce knowledge that is wrong. Here's the good news. The scientific method is still our best technology for uncovering, verifying, and refining correct knowledge, because what the scientific method allows us to do is make wrong knowledge gradually more correct. Usually, this refinement results in progressively more accurate theories, classical physics leading to relativity, leading to quantum physics, which leads to metaquantum ultraphysics, but it does sometimes result in entire theories being thrown out. End note. In this timeline, quantum physics has not led to metaquantum ultraphysics. Yet. End note. For example, in the 1700s CE, we thought that things burned because they were phlogisticated, that they were filled with phlogiston, an invisible and intangible substance that you couldn't see or touch or distill, but which was still required to make things burn. Things that were highly phlogisticated, like wood, burned quickly, while those that had less phlogiston in them burned less well, and ashes, having already been completely dephlogisticated, wouldn't burn at all. Phlogiston theory even explained why things got lighter when they burned. The phlogiston was floating away into the air. It also predicted that a match placed inside a sealed glass jar would eventually stop burning. The air in the jar would absorb all the phlogiston it could, and then the fire would go out. Matches in sealed glass jars do go out, so this all looked great. Done. Thanks, science. Now we know what fire is. Phlogiston theory started to fall apart when we did more experiments and found some results that didn't quite make sense. Sure, wood gets lighter when you burn it. the ashes left over clearly weigh less than the original wood did. But some metals, like magnesium, actually gain mass when burned. And now we had a problem. Results that did not agree with our theory. More science was needed. Some scientists tried to revise phlogiston to try to get it to match up with results. Maybe phlogiston could sometimes have negative mass, so the less you have of it in something, the more it would weigh. But this was a big leap, especially since negative mass matter was a completely new form of matter that was being invented simply to solve this phlogiston problem. Other scientists looked for a more conservative explanation, and the oxygen theory of combustion was what resulted. The idea that fire wasn't phlogiston leaving matter, but rather a chemical reaction between matter and oxygen, one that produces both light and heat. This theory also predicted that a match in a sealed jar will eventually stop burning, but for different reasons. The oxygen in the jar is consumed, and so the fire goes out, because oxygen fuels the chemical reaction that is fire. This is the more accurate theory of combustion that we still operate under today, but we could still be wrong. Or more likely, we could still be more correct. Here's how you produce knowledge using the scientific method. And here we have figure 8, the scientific method rendered as a cool atomic-looking thing. Step 1 is observe the world around you. This leads to step 2, ask a question about what you see. Leading to step 3, construct a hypothesis that could answer your question. Step 4, think of a way to test your hypothesis. Step 5, run experiments to see if your hypothesis's prediction was correct. Step 6, draw a conclusion from your experiments. Step 7, communicate your results. And step 8, refine, alter, or reject your hypothesis, which leads to step 1, observe the world around you, and it repeats. At the center of this is the nuclear core of science. An example. Maybe you notice, as per step 1, that your corn didn't grow well this year. For 2, you might ask, hey, what the heck, everyone? How come my corn didn't grow well this year? You might suspect the drought affected your corn's growth, step 3, and so, step 4, decide to grow corn under controlled conditions, giving each plant different amounts of water, but equal amounts of everything else you can think of, sunlight, fertilizer, and so on. After carefully doing that, step 5, you might conclude, step 6, that a precise amount of water grows the best corn plants. And 7, let your farmers know. And when your corn still doesn't grow as well as you want, you might explore and wonder, step 8, if there's more to growing great corn than just making sure your corn isn't thirsty. Footnote, there is. See section 5, Now We Are Become Farmers, the Devourers of Worlds, ideally before you are starving from a lack of delicious corn. End of footnote. The more ways a hypothesis has been tested, the more likely it is to be correct, but nothing is certain. The best case you can hope for by using the scientific method is a theory that happens to fit the facts as you understand them so far. Science gives you an explanation, but you can never say with absolute certainty that it's the correct one. That's why scientists talk about the theory of gravity, even though gravity itself clearly exists and can cause you to fall down the stairs. Theories of climate change, even though it's obvious our environment is not the same one our parents enjoyed or that you're enjoying right now, or the theory of time travel, even though it's a fact that you're clearly trapped in the past for reasons that cannot have any legal liability assigned. Note that the scientific method requires you to keep an open mind and be willing at any time to discard a theory that no longer fits the facts. This is not an easy thing to do, and many scientists have failed at it. Einstein himself hated how his own theory of relativity argued against his preferred idea of a fixed and stable universe, and for years tried in vain to find some solution that reconciled them both. Footnote. Albert Einstein was a scientist who, among other achievements, realized that matter and energy were equivalent and could be described by the equation energy is equivalent to mass times the speed of light squared, or E equals mc squared. Hey! Now, as far as anyone knows, you're as smart as Einstein. End of footnote. If you succeed at following the scientific method, you will be rewarded, because you will have produced knowledge that is reproducible, that anyone can check by doing the same experiment themselves. Scientists are often seen as turbo nerds, but the philosophical foundations of science are actually those of pure punk rock anarchy. Never respect authority, never take anyone's word on anything, and test all the things you think you know to confirm or deny them for yourself. Here we have figure 9 showing a A young woman in a lab coat wearing protective eye gear. She has a beaker in one hand. She's throwing up horns in the other, and it's labeled a typical scientist. Section 3.5. Calorie surplus, the end of hunting and gathering, and the beginning of civilization. Hunting and gathering, better ways to live your life. Beginning with our ancestors in prehistory, and continuing even past the appearance of anatomically modern humans around 200,000 BCE, humans spent all their time fully immersed in the fabulous hunting and gathering lifestyle. This is, as you might suspect, a situation in which hunters hunt while gatherers gather. You live off the earth, survive by your wits, and follow food wherever it might take you, leaving areas when you've exhausted their local resources. There are many benefits to this lifestyle. You get to eat a wide variety of foods, and a varied diet helps ensure good nutrition. You get to visit lots of interesting places, eat whatever lives there, and get lots of exercise. But this means food doesn't come to you. You have to go to it. And this is expensive. This expense manifests in several ways. It costs calories to search for food. It costs you years of your life, as you're much more likely to eat something new that happens to be toxic, or to get injured or killed by the very animals you're trying to gobble. Plus, you're constantly introduced to new bacteria and parasites as you chase after a food supply that's never assured. But its greatest expense comes from constantly moving. When you never know how long you'll be living somewhere, you're not going to build expensive and labor-intensive infrastructure. Anything you can't take with you can turn into wasted effort overnight. You won't store any resources long-term because there is no long-term. And for almost 200,000 years, the vast majority of human experience, this was all anyone did. Hunt, gather, maybe build some temporary settlements, and move on whenever the going got tough or someone saw a tasty-looking herd of animals over the next hill. It was only around 10,500 BCE that anyone thought to suggest that rather than taking the planet as it was when we come across it, we could instead change the planet to better suit our needs. End note. 10,500 BCE is used throughout this text as the date farming begins. My own research has around 2,000 years wiggle room on this date. End note. This idea of changing the planet represents both the invention of farming, the process of raising and caring for plants and animals in a convenient location so that food supplies are more reliable, and with it, full domestication, the process by which these plants and animals, once kept in a convenient location, are transformed into more convenient versions of themselves. Footnote, as you'll see in Section 8, while humans hadn't domesticated any plants before farming, they had managed to domesticate a few animals, including the dog. End of footnote. There was no reason this idea couldn't have occurred to us sooner, except that we either didn't think of it, or were too lazy to make it happen. Humanity wasted almost 200 millennia not having this idea. But it's already occurred to you, because you just read it. Look at you, you're already doing great. Once you begin farming and domesticating animals, you have entered a new phase of humanity, one in which a single human can reliably produce much more food than they need to survive. Humans run on food energy, calories, and you have just produced a surplus. In fact, a farmed field can produce anywhere from 10 to 100 times more calories than what you get by hunting and gathering an equal area of unfarmed land. And when you add more farmers and more arable land, you just add to the pile of extra food. It's on calorie surpluses, and therefore farming, that civilizations are built. How? Well, more food obviously lets you have more people, but it also lets those people stop worrying about where their next meal is coming from, freeing them up to start worrying about different, more productive things. Why stars seem to move across the sky, or how come things fall down instead of up? Farming also formalizes the idea of an economy in your civilization, since now farmers can regularly trade their food with others. With an economy comes specialization. Instead of each human having to do everything necessary to survive, or splitting it among a family group, now someone who's particularly talented at farming can focus all their efforts on that. A hunter and gatherer simply does not have the time to invent integral calculus, but a professor or a philosopher, someone who can both conceive of and devote themselves to such problems, does. Specialization gives the people in your civilization the opportunity to go further in any direction of study than any other human has gone before. It unlocks doctors who can devote their entire lives to curing disease, librarians who can devote their entire lives to ensuring the accumulated knowledge of humanity remains safe and accessible, and writers who, fresh out of school, take the first job they find and devote the most productive years of their lives to writing corporate repair manuals for rental market time machines that their bosses almost certainly don't even read, ironically for so little money that they can't possibly afford to go back and fix that one horrible, horrible mistake. Footnote. That's right, you're not fooling anyone, Chad. I know you just run a word count on whatever I write and call it a day. Honestly, I just pasted in some of your more embarrassing mass emails and be done with this project, except for one little thing. Time travelers really could get stuck in the past. I don't want to leave them hopeless and alone. So here's the deal, stranded time traveler. We're both trapped. You in the past, me in a job I hate. You and I are going to get through this together, okay? We're going to do well. I'm toning down the dry corporate language that Chad thought was so important, and you're going to promise to build into your civilization the cultural tradition that years down the road, if anyone should happen to meet my boss, they should tell him he's a tool. They'll be able to recognize him instantly. His name will be Chad, the Chad, Packard, and he'll have the world's most punchable face. Listen, I'm rooting for you. Oh, one more thing. Maybe also build in the tradition that if one day someone should meet a Ryan North, fresh out of school and about to take the first job he finds, give him a heads up. End of footnote. Specialization goes hand in hand with a civilization's development, because the greatest resource of your or any civilization is not land, power, or even technology. It's human brains, yours and those of the humans around you. They'll be the creative, inventive, brilliant engines that drive your civilization forward. And it's specialization, supplied by a calorie surplus, that allows those human brains to reach their full potential. Unfortunately, the advantages we've just outlined do come with several challenges. While we believe the benefits do outweigh the drawbacks, you should be aware of the following extremely garbage features of farming. When wild food is abundant, farming is way more work than hunting and gathering. What farming offers, though, is a promise of a more reliable food source and, through domestication, more convenient food sources too. Farming also requires technologies for food storage, because its whole point is to produce more food than you can eat at once. This again is more work, but thanks to Section 10.2.4, Preserved Foods, you at least have the advantage of knowing exactly what to do. Farming creates the first income inequality, because not everyone can be farmers or share equally in the land required for it. Farmers have the most food and, initially, the most to trade, and everyone who doesn't want to become a skeleton needs to continue eating food. You have just created rich and poor people, or at the very least, the potential for them. Farming requires infrastructure, fences and so on, which means you are no longer mobile. Your civilization has just become a giant and stationary target. While this text does not include explicit instructions for weaponry, we're certain that, should the need arise, you can probably adapt several of the technologies included here to that purpose. Animals carry diseases and can transmit them to humans. Worse, some of our deadliest diseases don't bother animals at all. Over 60% of all human diseases originate from close contact with animals, including such all-time champion diseases as anthrax, Ebola, plague, salmonella, listeriosis, rabies, and ringworm. We understand if, after reading that list, you want to go back to hunting and gathering, but we promise civilization will eventually be worth it. Just don't be surprised if people start getting sick, and maybe read Section 14, Heal Somebody, before it's critical. In light of these downsides, we would like to take this opportunity to remind you that it is inarguable that farming leads to calorie surpluses, which leads to specialization, which leads to innovations like apple pies, time machines, and the latest mass-market portable music players. If you work hard, you will produce these. If you hunt and gather, you will not. Instead, you will eat bugs you find under a rock. Best of luck with your decision. Chapter 4. Units of measurement are arbitrary, but here's how you can reinvent the standard ones used in this book from scratch. Can you really reinvent measurement while trapped in the past? We wouldn't rule it out. All units of measurement are arbitrary, but the vast majority of humanity agrees you should at least make them practical by having your units scale predictably, combine intuitively, and be easy to reproduce while trapped in the primordial past. Footnote. We say the vast majority because there remain precisely three holdout countries that insist on not using the otherwise predictable and global standard of weights and measures: Liberia, Myanmar, and the United States. The United States has had actual spacecraft, the Mars Climate Orbiter, collide with actual planets, Mars, because they insisted on using their archaic units while the rest of the world has agreed on a more practical standard, then forgot that they did that, and then messed up their orbital trajectories because some calculations used metric and others didn't. Even the $327.6 million American dollars wasted on that 1999 CE impact did not give the United States enough motivation to join the rest of the world in standard units of measurement. They wouldn't budge an inch. End of footnote. Accordingly, in this guide, we use the metric system of measurement, which is based on units of 10, along with the centigrade temperature system, which ensures you can replicate those measurements no matter what time period you're stranded in. All you need is this book and some water. The centigrade temperature system is defined by locking in 0 degrees centigrade, or 0 degrees C, as the point water freezes, and 100 degrees C as a point where it boils. You can therefore reproduce it easily no matter what time you're in. Just mark those two points in your thermometer, see section 10.7.2, divide what's left into 100 equal segments, and you've done it. Footnote, well, you've almost done it. See section 10.7.2 for some important details. Water also behaves differently at different pressures, so these numbers are calibrated for sea level as opposed to at the top of a mountain or the bottom of a mine. End of footnote. The competing Fahrenheit system, in contrast, locks in 0 degrees as the temperature of a weird slurry of ice, water, and salt that Mr. Fahrenheit threw together before calling it a day, and we will discuss it no further, except to say 32 degrees Fahrenheit is about where water freezes, 212 degrees is about where it boils, and you can do so much better. End note. Mr. Fahrenheit's mixture of ice, salt, and water wasn't quite as random as it sounds. It's an example of a frigorific mixture, which is a name given to mixtures that tend to stabilize around a certain temperature, as long as all the ingredients in it aren't consumed. Ice and water makes a frigorific mixture that stabilizes around 0 degrees Celsius, regardless of the initial temperatures of their ingredients, and ice, water, and salt form one that stabilizes at around negative 17.8 degrees Celsius, or if you insist, 0 degrees Fahrenheit. End of note. If you'd like to operate without negative numbers, you can invent the Kelvin temperature scale, which is just degrees centigrade, but with 0 Kelvin set to negative 273.15 degrees Celsius, the coldest temperature possible in our universe. Water freezes at 273.2 degrees Kelvin and boils at 373.2 degrees. So that takes care of temperature. Weight will base around the kilogram, which until 2019 CE was still tied to actual prototype kilograms, physical masses of platinum safely stored worldwide in nested bell jars, so that humans can point to it and say, a kilogram is however much that hunk of platinum weighs. End note. At the time of publication, 2018 CE, this was still the case. However, the General Conference on Weights and Measures, the intergovernmental organization responsible for such things, is expected to vote on a new definition for the kilogram in November 2018 CE, to come into effect on May 20th, 2019 CE. Assuming it succeeds, on that day, the definition of the kilogram will change from the physical reference stored in France to a new definition based on the Planck constant, which is a number central to quantum mechanics. Like the other modern definitions of standard units, this new definition is not much use to anyone stranded in the past, or present for that matter, who doesn't have the time, money, or inclination to measure the linear momentum of photons. End note. There was a canonical copy stored in France, and dozens of duplicates placed throughout the world for both convenience and safekeeping. After all, you don't want anyone stealing the only kilogram in a dramatic and elaborate heist, leaving the entire world unsure of precisely how much 1 kilogram weighs. There are several downsides to this idea, even factoring in the undeniable allure of heisting the kilogram. These backup kilograms were occasionally returned to France to verify that they were all still the same weight, and the thing is, they weren't. Different kilograms stored throughout the world, even those made from the initial batch of 40 cast in 1884 CE, were becoming different weights, drifting ever so slightly apart over time. and until time travel was invented, we didn't even know why. Endnote, which, unfortunately for us non-time travelers, means that in our time, you and I still don't actually know why the kilograms are changing mass. Oh well, file that under unsolved science mysteries you would have thought we'd have figured out by now, alongside, where does the sun's magnetic field come from? Why are plate tectonics seen only on Earth? And we don't actually know why we sleep or what its biological function is, haha. We only spend a third of our lives doing this. I'm sure it's no big deal. End note. It gets worse. Since the measurements comparing the weight of prototype kilograms are all relative to one another, this left open the possibility that all kilograms were gaining or losing mass, and some were just better at it than others. As kilograms are a central measure in the metric system, contributing to the definitions of units of force, newtons, pressure, pascals, energy, joules, and power, watts, amperes, and volts, not to mention all the myriad other units spun off from those, you can easily see how even a minor change in the mass of the official kilogram would redefine a metric ton of other units across disparate fields of measurement. Civilization pro tip. There are downsides to building the foundations of modern science and measurement around the mass of an old hunk of metal in a jar in France. Luckily for you, you won't need such precise measurements for a very, very long time. And the amount that these prototype kilograms were supposed to weigh was defined simply as the weight of 10 cubic centimeters of water at 4 degrees Celsius. You've already got water, and you've got temperature, so all you need to know now is how big a centimeter is, and you can easily reproduce a kilogram. Before we do that, some terminology. All metric units scale up and down by powers of 10, which are indicated by prefixes. Here are some common ones from smaller to larger. And here we have table 6, which has three columns, prefix, symbol, and scale. The first is nano, symbol, the letter N, which is a billion times smaller. Micro, symbol mu, which is 100,000 times smaller. Milli, symbol M, 1,000 times smaller. Centi, symbol C, 100 times smaller. Deci, symbol D, 10 times smaller. Then no symbol is actual size. Deca, symbol DA, 10 times bigger. Hecto, symbol H, 100 times bigger. Kilo, symbol K, 1,000 times bigger. Mega, symbol capital M, 1,000,000 times bigger. And giga, symbol capital G, 1,000,000,000 times bigger. Table 6 is labeled a true megachart. Centimeters are 1/100th the size of a meter, and you know that because of the centi prefix. Similarly, the word kilometer tells you it's 1,000 times longer than a meter, 1,000 meters. We usually abbreviate meters as M, making centimeters CM and kilometers KM. So how long is a meter anyway? The meter started in 1793 CE and was defined as 1/10,000,000th of the distance from the equator to the North Pole. It was redefined in 1799 CE to be tied to a physical prototype, like the kilogram, redefined again in 1960 CE to be the wavelength of the emissions of one particular isotope of the element krypton, and again in 1983 CE to be the precise distance light travels in a vacuum over 1/299,000,000th, 792,000th, 458th of a second. Given your current circumstances, you probably already noticed how these definitions started out completely useless to you, but then somehow still managed to get worse. Luckily, we noticed that too, and so have printed a handy 10-centimeter ruler in this section, as well as an arguably more convenient one on the dust jacket, so you don't need to mess around with any of that. From that, you can construct meter sticks that will be pretty darn close to accurate. Just as an aside real quick, I know you're listening to the audio version, and so you don't have this 10-centimeter ruler specimen. However, we put one online at howtoinventeverything.com, so be sure to download that, preferably before you get trapped in time. So now you've got standard measurements for length, weight, and temperature. The only major unit left for you to define is time, which is based on the second. While the modern definition of the second is the frankly ludicrous, however long it takes 9,192,631,770 periods of the radiation corresponding to the transition between the two hyperfine levels of the ground state of the cesium-133 atom, you intuitively know how long that takes. It's 1 second. So all you need is a convenient reference. To produce a device that can indicate 1 second without requiring cesium-133, you'll need to construct a simple harmonic isolator, which in non-time machine repair jargon means tie a rock to a string. A rock tied to a string that can swing freely is called a pendulum, and it turns out that 1 second is the time it takes any pendulum on Earth, regardless of weight, to swing from one end to the other, as long as that pendulum is 99.4 centimeters long. This cool property of pendulums, that they always take just about the same amount of time to complete a swing, no matter how far back you pull the weight before letting it drop, makes this a particularly easy experiment to perform. This property was discovered by a guy named Galileo Galilei in 1602, but you're going to take the credit. It's your property now. As we saw, other units can be built up from these measurements. We've got weight and length, but to measure volume, you'll need liters. Conveniently, a liter is the area enclosed by a cube 10 centimeters wide on each side, the same size cube that, when filled with water, weighs exactly 1 kilogram. For sound, you'll want to measure frequency, which is simply the number of vibrations per second. A hertz, or HZ for short, is one complete cycle per second, so a frequency of 20 hertz just means 20 vibrations per second. For physics, the amount of force required to accelerate a 1 kilogram mass by 1 meter per second squared is called a newton. The amount of energy transferred to that object over 1 meter is called a joule, and a watt is simply 1 joule per second. These units might seem abstract, but they'll come in handy with some of the technologies you'll be inventing later on. And with that, the tiny centimeter has helped unlock measurement of not just length, but volume, mass, force, energy, and time itself. If you're using the pages of this guide for toilet paper, and you shouldn't, why would you be doing that? Use anything else. Maybe save this page for last. Footnote. We recommend measuring and then memorizing the width of your pinky finger now. It'll be a useful approximation if you ever lose your reference ruler. And don't worry. If you do lose a centimeter but have already created a 1 kilogram reference mass, you can recover the centimeter by making different sized cubes and filling them with water until one matches its weight perfectly. You can use the balance scale you invent in section 10.12.6 to test them. Metric is a time traveler's friend. End of footnote. Chapter 5. Now we are become farmers, the devourers of worlds. How you too can be outstanding in your field. Wouldn't it be nice if you had machines that ran on water and light and turned gross dirt into delicious food and fun chemicals? Also, wouldn't it be nice if the machines were self-duplicating, self-improving, and, most exciting of all, not all of them wanted to kill you? Good news! These machines exist. They're called plants, and they will be some of your greatest resources in your new civilization. Think of them as free technology. Machines you can use, even by accident, to transform the inedible dirt around you, the boring light above you, and the tedious water that falls from the sky into all sorts of useful materials, medicines, chemicals, and foods your civilization requires. If we did not already have plants, we would think they are magic. But they are everywhere and evolved before we did, so most of us think they're pretty boring. It took humans almost 200,000 years to realize we could do more than just gather them up when we were hungry. We could instead domesticate them, growing them in an environment safer from predators, where we could be choosy, picking the plants that did more of what we wanted and less of what we didn't. This is called selective breeding, by the way, and you just invented it. Selective breeding. Here's all you need to do. 1. Find a plant, or animal, this also works on animals, that has exceptional properties you like. Maybe it produces more kernels of delicious and nutritious corn than your other plants, or lasts longer in storage, or resists pests and drought, or maybe even all of the above. 2. Plant seeds from that plant instead of seeds from your other, crummier plants. If you're working with animals, let only the ones you like reproduce. Step 3. Repeat. By doing this over successive seasons, you will produce crops that emphasize whatever properties you choose almost by accident. Here are 3 examples of what humans have wrought with the mighty power of selective breeding alone. Here we have table 7, food used to suck. There's 4 columns. The first is fruit or vegetable, then first domesticated, then modern variety you used to enjoy like it wasn't even a big deal, and finally, incredibly disappointing ancient ancestor. The first is corn, first domesticated in 7000 BCE. The modern variety is about 190 millimeters long, it peels easily, it's sweet and juicy, and has 800 soft kernels. The incredibly disappointing ancient ancestor is about 19 millimeters long, which is 10 times smaller and 1,000 times less volume. It peels by being smashed into pieces, it tastes like a dry, raw potato, and it contains from 5 to 10 very hard kernels. The next is the peach, first domesticated around 5500 BCE. The modern variety is around 100 millimeters long with a 9 to 1 flesh to stone ratio. It's a soft and edible skin and it's sweet and juicy. The incredibly disappointing ancient ancestor is about 25 millimeters long. That's 4 times smaller, 64 times less volume. It has a 3 to 2 flesh to stone ratio. It has a waxy skin and it tastes earthy, sour, and slightly salty. Finally, we have watermelon, first domesticated around 3000 BCE. The modern variety is around 500 millimeters long. It's available in seedless varieties. It's easily opened. You can just punch your way in. It's almost fat and starch-free, and it has a delicious taste and a sweet smell. The incredibly disappointing ancient ancestor is only 5 millimeters long, which is 100 times smaller and almost a million times less volume. It contains around 18 bitter, nutty seeds. It requires a hammer or some sort of smashing to open it. It's high in starch, high in fat, has a bitter taste, and an unpleasant smell. Yum. And these were all bred before we knew what genetics were, before we knew we could induce plants and animals to evolve for us, and before we knew that directed selective breeding could have effects within a single human lifetime. But you already know all this stuff. You're ahead of the game already. There is, however, a downside to planting the same thing over and over. Rather than letting you find out by surprise and then starving to death like countless other humans have throughout time, we thought we'd tell you. Growing the same plant repeatedly will kill your soil slowly and then you more quickly. Luckily, you can solve this problem with a technology called crop rotation. What's crop rotation, you ask, as allured as you are entertained? We're more than happy to answer. Crop rotation. There are three simple but extremely critical things to keep in mind about plants. 1. Plants use the sun's energy to become big and delicious. 2. The chemical they use to extract that solar energy is called chlorophyll. 3. Nitrogen is a critical ingredient in chlorophyll. It's an oversimplification to call nitrogen magic plant food, but it's not far off. It's the most commonly supplied plant nutrient around the world, and the whole reason plants like the Venus flytrap and pitcher plants evolved actual carnivorous mouths was simply to harvest the nitrogen from passing insects. The good news, if you're alive enough to read this, then Earth's atmosphere is full of nitrogen. The bad news, plants can't access it there. Instead, they take it from the soil. And since plants remove nitrogen from soil and don't replenish it, if you plant the same thing over and over, you're going to have some very, very bad problems. Specifically, you will have these particular very, very bad problems. 1. The soil will exhaust its nitrogen, along with the other nutrients required by your crop, meaning your crop will grow progressively less well every year until it fails entirely. 2. Pests and diseases attracted by the crop you keep constantly planting will thrive, as there is no interruption to their life cycles or habitat. 3. By not having different crops in rotation at the same time, you are vulnerable to complete starvation if your crop fails. 4. Crops with shallow root systems cause dirt not to stick together as well, and your soil will erode away. 5. Crops with shallow root systems leave less biomass in the soil after harvesting, which leaves it less nutrient-rich for the next crop. And 6. Your farm will be sad and boring, and you'll have the same thing for dinner every night. To avoid these problems, you need to allow the soil to recover. Unless you've got an extreme case, recovery is easy. Just till the ground, but don't plant anything for a year. In farmer talk, this is letting the field lie fallow while your animals hang out there. Tilling kills weeds, and your animals' poop and pee are full of nitrogen, so it restores the soil. Footnote, we know what you're thinking. Wait, if animal poop has nitrogen in it, then human poop does too, right? Can I truly poop my way to a fun and productive civilization? This is a bad idea for several reasons. First, it's unpleasant. Human poop tends to smell worse to humans than other animal poops. But more critically, human poop, which, when used as fertilizer, is charmingly and euphemistically referred to as night soil, and also less charmingly and less euphemistically referred to as fecal sludge, contains all sorts of pathogens humans are vulnerable to, including other people's parasitic worms, which can then easily infect you, the farmer. If you don't have the technology to remove parasites from poop yet, in section 10.2.4, Preserve Foods, you'll figure out a way to do it, but you'll literally be pasteurizing your poop. It's probably not worth the risk. But the good news is that you don't need to worry about pee. Human pee is fine. Pee in a field all you want. End of footnote. So, great. Your soil will be fine, as long as you don't mind not eating anything for a full year. And at this point, if you're thinking you could easily improve this system by farming only half your fields each year, while the other half recovers, congratulations, you just invented crop rotation. Footnote, congratulations, you also just invented working half as hard while pitching it as a net gain for civilization. End of footnote. Specifically, you've invented two-field crop rotation. It looks like this. Here we have Table 8, the two-field crop rotation system featuring both foods and poops. There's two columns, Field 1 and Field 2. In Year 1, Field 1 is where you plant whatever food you want, and in Field 2 you let it lie fallow so that animals can graze here and their poops fertilize the land. In Year 2, Field 1 lies fallow, animals graze here so the poops fertilize the land, and Field 2 is where you plant whatever food you want. This system leaves 50% of your fields unproductive, but it's simple, it's reliable, and it lets you eat every year. But if you want to get fancier and or want to answer people's complaints about how nice it would be to farm at greater than 50% efficiency, you can invent three-field crop rotation. It works like this. Here we have Table 9, the three-field crop rotation system. Now you're planting twice a year and working twice as hard. What a world. There's three columns, Field 1, Field 2, and Field 3. In Year 1, Field 1 lies fallow. Animals poop there. In Field 2, in fall, you plant wheat and rye, which is going to be human food. In Field 3, in spring, you plant oats and barley, which will be animal food, plus legumes. Year 2, Field 1, that's where you're planting your oats and barley in spring. Field 2 is lying fallow, and Field 3 is where you're planting your wheat and rye in fall. In Year 3, Field 1 is where you're planting wheat and rye in fall. Field 2 is where you're planting oats and barley in spring, and Field 3 is where you're letting it lie fallow. You're now planting and harvesting twice as much food, which requires labor or better plows. Historically, the moldboard plow does the trick, see section 10.2.3, but this does bump you up to 66% productivity. But with the fields being used twice before they're harvested, won't the soil get exhausted? The answer lies in the legumes you were planting. Legumes are dry fruit contained within a shell or pod, and they include plants like chickpeas, regular peas, soybeans, regular beans, alfalfa, clover, lentils, and peanuts. We've listed them out just now because you'll definitely want to farm at least one of these bad boys. Why? Besides being reasonably tasty, legumes are one of the few plants that can host certain bacteria called rhizobia, though of course you can call them whatever you want, in their roots. And these bacteria do something extremely valuable, something that no other plant on earth can do on its own. They add nitrogen back into soil. Specifically, when rhizobia infect plants, they act as a symbiote, taking some carbon produced in the plant during photosynthesis, and in return, converting nitrogen gas, N2, into a form plants can use, NH3, or ammonia, which is stored in the roots of that plant as nodules. And when you harvest these plants, leaving the roots in the ground, both nitrogen and rhizobia return to the soil to wait for the next planting. The legumes, or rather the bacteria that infect them, are the glue that holds this whole three-field crop rotation thing together. Civilization lasts only as long as people are kept fed. And while three-field crop rotation allows you to increase your food output, thereby increasing the maximum size of your civilization, and therefore the number of human brains available to it, it also means that everything you do, from your smallest victories to your greatest accomplishments, will depend on a bunch of invisible, single-celled microbes that live in the dirt. If they fall, so too falls your civilization. Civilization pro tip, don't forget to plant your legumes. But can we get even more efficient? Can we be so bold as to invent a four-field crop rotation system bringing efficiency up to 75% or, dare we dream, 100%. It took hundreds of years for humans to muster up the courage to even consider doing such a thing, but you bet your calorie surplus we can. Here we have Table 10. Finally, a way to farm that doesn't require anyone to take any time off ever. Progress. There's four columns, field 1, field 2, field 3, and field 4. In year 1, field 1 is wheat, field 2 is turnips, field 3 is barley, field 4 is clover. In year 2, field 1 is turnips, field 2 is barley, field 3 is clover, field 4 is wheat. In year 3, field 1 is barley, field 2 is clover, field 3 is wheat, field 4 is turnips, and in year 4, field 1 is clover, field 2 is wheat, field 3 is turnips, and field 4 is barley. This is a system of crops that works to support both the land and the farmer. Wheat is for humans, barley and turnips are intended for both humans and livestock, turnips keep well over winter to feed animals, and clover restores the soil. Any legume works, but clover is especially good at it. Footnote: clover's so good for soil that it's sometimes referred to as green manure, one of the few instances in history in which that phrase is intended as a compliment. End footnote. In addition, animals can graze on the fields during the turnip and clover phases, which helps control weeds. Each field goes 3 years before the same crop is grown again, which starves pests that could survive if the plant they fed on was grown more frequently. If you don't have all these crops in your area, you can substitute other plants as long as the nitrogen keeps being restored. Footnote: it's hard to tell you've exhausted the soil until it's too late, so you may want to keep simpler 2- and 3-field systems going until you're confident that your selection of plants works in a 4-field rotation. End of footnote. Be careful, though. When you don't let a field rest, you can overplow it, which causes problems. See section 10.2.3, plows. You might be feeling like humans are pretty smart for figuring all this stuff out, but here's something embarrassing. The science for this nitrogen stuff all came later. Instead, we just used trial and error over thousands and thousands of years, which meant even the most basic 2-field crop rotation didn't show up until 6000 BCE, and 4-field crop rotation arrived only in the 1700 CE. That's more than 20,000 years just to invent non-crappy farming. And it gets worse. That symbiosis between rhizobia and legumes, which is what makes advanced crop rotation possible, first evolved over 65 million years ago. That's far enough back that actual dinosaurs could have invented our most complicated system of crop rotation if only they were smart enough to, and had tried to, and had also not been horrifically killed by asteroids. Footnote: not all species of dinosaur were horrifically killed by asteroids. Some made it to the present day by evolving into birds, and others made it to the present day by being taken there in time machines. Upon arriving in the present day, dinosaurs are usually placed in special Jurassic parks, which, like the FC-3000, have only rarely suffered catastrophic failures for which no legal liability can be assigned. End of footnote. Besides nitrogen, plants also need calcium and phosphorus. You can get phosphorus from bones and calcium from teeth, so recycling animal skeletons is a good idea. You can crush and boil them to produce bone meal, an easier to spread alternative to chucking bones into a field, and by reacting the bone meal with sulfuric acid, see Appendix C.12, you produce a phosphate that's easier for plants to use, and therefore a more effective fertilizer. Now that you know about selective breeding and crop rotation, you, or members of your civilization if you're not the farming type, are ready to efficiently farm. However, depending on where and when you are, different plants and animals will be available to you. These are detailed in the next two sections. Most of the biomass on Earth is useless for feeding humans. It's either indigestible, poisonous, dangerous, too tedious to gather or prepare, or not nutritious enough to make it worthwhile. But don't despair. A small minority of the plants and animals on this planet are really useful to humans, providing shelter, food, and treatment for diseases. Hey, fingers crossed you're near some of those ones. Chapter 6. What will other humans be eating if I'm stranded after they've evolved, but before agriculture and selective breeding are a thing? And how can I tell if it's poisonous, because I bet some of those ancient humans are eating some really stupid stuff? Great news. You can eat anything once. We don't know a lot about the fruits and vegetables from this era, from between 200,000 BCE and 10,500 BCE, as most temporal research on this period has focused on more interesting questions like, What did mitochondrial Eve, who, even without time machines, we know lived between 99,000 and 148,000 years ago, and is the most recent common female ancestor of every single human alive today, look like? In case you're curious, she looked pretty great. The male equivalent, Y-chromosomal Adam, is the most recent ancestor from which all humans in the present